Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join us on the exchange, feel free. Phone numbers are as follows. Anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Maybe you got to a point in your life when you thought, I remember the negative experiences really well, but I don't hold on to the positive ones as well. What's wrong with me? The answer in most cases is nothing. There are reasons for the brain to hold on to the less pleasant moments with greater tenacity. And today's guest shares those reasons in his book, Hardwiring Happiness. Dr. Rick Hansen, Ph.D., is a neuropsychologist and the author of several books. In this one, we not only learn about the mechanisms of the brain, but how to work around them, hence the term hardwiring happiness. Dr. Rick Hansen, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, it's a pleasure to be here, and please call me Rick, or I'll have to call you Mr. Riley.
Fair enough. Rick is
okay,
fine.
Good.
So one of the points right off the bat, the brain tells us lies. Is that what you're telling us?
In a sense, I mean, the brain was designed for one purpose, to keep animals alive under very, very harsh conditions. So part of that requires seeing opportunities, you know, quote-unquote carrots, like food or shelter and so forth. But it especially involves seeing, quote-unquote, sticks, like predators, aggression in a primate band, natural hazards, and so forth. That's because the so-called sticks in nature have more urgency and impact than the so-called carrots do. If you fail to get a carrot today, you'll have a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So now we have a brain with what scientists call a negativity bias. I call it, it's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. And it means that we over-remember, we over-learn from, especially emotional learning. You know, kind of subconscious learning. We overlearn from our negative experiences, but unfortunately underlearn from our positive ones, even though our positive experiences are the primary source of the inner strengths we all want to develop inside, like resilience or a positive mood.
So is this why we remember the guy who cut us off in the parking lot at the movie theater, but not the great movie we watched for 3 hours before that?
100%. Or think about a relationship that's even more important, someone you live with or work with or sleep with, or in the case of my wife, all three. 10 things happen in a day. 5 are positive, 4 are neutral, 1 is negative. Which one do you think about as you're falling asleep? Or that's why research shows that good, strong relationships need at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions.
So the reason, again, though, is you're going to change your behavior. Basically, this is a real biological level of those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it.
There you have Santayana's great quote. Yeah. And for me, the takeaway point here, so I'm a neuropsychologist and longtime therapist and teacher and parent and so forth, and what I've gotten really interested in is the actual how of personal growth. In other words, if you think about some quality you want to develop in yourself, you know, feeling more resilient, even-keeled, happier, more secure, more confident, what have you. The question really is, how do you grow it inside yourself? And that takes us to the brain and the ways in which the brain is actually quite poor at growing your qualities inside itself. So what my book's about is using the neuropsychology of learning in incredibly practical ways so that people can actually tap the hidden power in everyday experiences to begin to encode them in neural structure, thereby using, you know, half a dozen opportunities a day, a dozen seconds at a time, to grow these strengths inside themselves.
So, Rick, what kinds of training and exploration make you a neuropsychologist as opposed
right,
to just
right.
a plain old psychologist?
Yeah, it's I'm a plain old clinical psychologist, licensed in California, et cetera, PhD and all that. And in most states, a neuropsychologist is a more general term. And in my case, it means someone who has done a lot of work at the intersection between the mind and the brain. In particular, my focus is on cultivating and developing positive qualities in ourselves. Many neuropsychologists get involved in assessing negative events, like the impact of a concussion or a head injury in a car accident, say.
All right. Now, apparently, you stumbled upon this concept of how to take in the good in college. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, I think we all know how to do what I call taking in the good, which is the simple process of helping a passing mental state become installed in your brain as a useful neural trait. That's a fancy way of saying or describing something that we all have done, which is, for example, having a moment where something good is experiencing, where we're feeling something good. Like, let's say we accomplished something or someone paid us a compliment, or we have one of those moments, you know, under the stars that are particularly special. And we help it last. We'd say to ourselves, for example, hey, this one's a keeper. Let this one sink in. Or I really want to learn this good lesson here, whatever that is for us. Okay, we tend to do that somewhat informally, and I've gotten very interested in learning how to help the brain do it really well. I stumbled upon my own version of this, as you said there, Jeff, in college when I was really quite insecure. I was a totally shy, dorky kid growing up, very young, going through school, and I had a lot of experiences of being mistreated by other kids. You know, nothing horrible, but still, it added up. But in college, and then in adulthood and young adulthood especially, I learned that if I could just stay with an experience 10, 20 seconds straight of a, on the 0 to 10 intensity scale, a 1 or a 2, you know, a realistic, authentic, mild, positive experience. A girl would smile at me. Some guys would say, hey, let's go get pizza, whatever. But if I stayed with it, I could gradually feel that this positive experience was, in effect, sinking into me. And then 20, 30 years later, I began to realize as someone increasingly knowledgeable about the brain that I'd actually been restructuring my own brain in the process.
So really just something as simple as enjoying the smell of the air on a nice autumn day or the sun on your face. I mean, just taking a few seconds to do that begins that process?
Exactly right. It starts the process of transferring the experience from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. But to do that, you really need to stay with it 10, 20, 30 seconds straight and help it be strong. But that's still a very enjoyable practice that's gradually rebuilding your brain.
Okay, much more about the practices of rebuilding the brain. The book is called Hardwiring Happiness. Its author is Rick Hansen. He's our guest. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. More with Rick Hansen and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the concept of working around the structures of your brain, because the brain does have a negativity bias for reasons that help keep us alive when we came out of the trees. We tend to hold on to the bad experiences so we don't repeat them. Getting around those, his book is called Hardwiring Happiness. Rick Hansen's our guest. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We do have an email here already from an anonymous listener. I don't tend to take anonymous emails, but this one is pretty good advice, it sounds like. When I get up in the morning, I have two choices. I can be happy or unhappy. I choose to be happy. When it's raining, cold, and miserable out, I just remember that 40,000 feet straight up, it's a beautiful sunny day. As my father always told us, life is what you make of it. This kind of gets back to the old Abraham Lincoln statement, Rick Hansen, doesn't it, about most folks are as happy as they make up their minds to be?
That's, I think, partially true. And what I mean by that is that, like the caller, you know, I think having a good perspective on things, seeing the whole truth, not just the part of the truth that the Stone Age brain tends to fasten on, you know, the bad news, that's really important, seeing the whole truth. But it's not, how can I put it, but it's important to not just have a positive experience. What's important is that we actually weave it into neural structure. Otherwise, it's wasted on the brain.
So it's more practice and more actual work involved here to get this integrated into.
Yeah, again, you know, half a dozen times a day, less than half a minute at a time. But if we don't actually take that time, as a longtime therapist, it's actually been quite humbling for me to appreciate that most positive experiences are wasted on the brain. They don't become any kind of lasting structure. And if they don't become lasting structure, there's no learning. There's no steepening of a person's learning curve. There's no takeaway in terms of becoming more confident, more moral, more mindful, more compassionate, happier, more functional, what have you. There's no learning. So when a person does take that 30, 40,000 foot view, as your emailer is saying, you know, it's also really important to take the extra 10 seconds to help that perspective sink in. So it becomes increasingly your own habit. In effect, I'm really talking about the how of developing good habits, using that term really broadly.
We have heard the term neuroplasticity used by several guests in the last few months and last couple of years, I guess, actually. So we're up on the concept of the ability of the brain to rewire and find new neural pathways and all that sort of thing. But you talk about experience-dependent neuroplasticity. How is that different, or what's the subspecialty there?
Sure. In general, in terms of neuroplasticity, that just means, that, as you know, the capacity of the brain to change itself. Experience-dependent neuroplasticity refers to the changes that occur through conscious experience, you know, what we think or feel or want moment to moment. Self-directed neuroplasticity is the idea that we can take charge of this structure building our process ourselves from the inside out. The brain is the organ that learns. It's continually changing its structure, and it's biased toward changing its structure toward anxiety, depressed mood, irritation, or stress. So the question really is your brain changing for better or worse, and also who's doing the changing? Is it the forces outside us impacting the Stone Age brain, or from the inside out, are we looking for those opportunities, again, in the flow of everyday life, most of them individually mild, all of them authentic opportunities, to take the extra 10 or 30 seconds to use the methods in my book based on hundreds of studies in the neuropsychology of learning? Are we taking those opportunities to draw the good into us so we increasingly have it inside, unconditionally present already, wherever we go?
You write about picking, when you think about these things, the experiences that serve you most. And I would think that would tend to work in both positive and negative experiences.
That's very interesting. You read the book closely. I appreciate that. Yeah, if you think about it, one of the most powerful ways to use the opportunity that's available to us in everyday life to rewire our own brains gradually and authentically is to zero in on those experiences that would be the basis of, the natural basis for those particular strengths or qualities or perspectives or emotions that would be really good to grow inside yourself to deal with some difficult thing, either a challenge in your life these days, such as raising a young child or taking care of an aging parent. I've done both. Or maybe you're dealing with some kind of wound or a sense of emotional neglect from your childhood. You know, in my own case, there was a longing in me related to being extremely young going through school for more experiences of being valued and included in groups of people by my peers. So if you know what your issue is, as it were, then it's natural to ask yourself, what resource, if it were more present inside my mind, would really help here? And then you can look for opportunities to have experiences of that resource. For example, moments of feeling cared about by others, or moments of experiencing some sense of accomplishment, or moments of sensing your own inner strength or feeling protected, let's say, if you're grappling with issues of anxiety. You can look for those moments and gradually use them as what I call antidote experiences to address your underlying needs.
So this involves obviously some frankness, some honesty with yourself to understand what it is that you lack. As you describe it in the book, a hole in your heart that needed filling. You figured out how to fill yours. First of all, does everybody have a hole in their heart? And second of all, how hard is it for some people to figure out what it's going to take to fill it?
Yeah, I think everybody has issues that they're dealing with and therefore opportunities to grow more good things inside themselves. You know, my own view, and it's not an original view, is that life's about learning. And also my own view is that life has many difficulties. Life is hard in a lot of ways. It's often hard in profound ways for people. So the question then becomes, how do we deal with the hard things in life? How do we grow the resilience, the even-keeledness, the perspective, you know, the unconditional happiness, the inner peace, what have you? How do we grow those things inside ourselves? And if you know, now some people in particular, me included, I think a large fraction of the population, have issues that have still lingered from their childhood or from experiences they've had in adulthood, maybe a rocky marriage or a tough job or being mistreated or betrayed by somebody that still lingers inside yourself. You can address the lingering effects of that by deliberately looking for those positive experiences that are the natural antidote to that issue. And if you want, you can use the fourth step of this four-step process, as you know, Jeff, in the book, that links positive experiences with the negative material inside yourself that these positive experiences are the natural antidote for, by simply being aware of both a useful positive experience and its related negative material. Since, quote-unquote, neurons that fire together wire together, you can gradually associate the positive material to the negative. This is a very familiar method, you know, in psychology. I certainly didn't invent it. But you can do it really skillfully in everyday life and gradually heal yourself from the inside out.
And the HEAL becomes an acronym in your hands. Have a positive experience, enrich it, absorb it, and link the positive and the negative. And the whole back part of the book, the whole second part of the book, is really about engaging the HEAL process. But before we get there, though, we need some of our primitive responses still, don't we? I mean, this is what keeps us alive.
Oh, and, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, a very subtle and important point. You know, we need the whole brain working together. I think sometimes the reptile brain gets a bad name. You know, it's a very important part of us, you know, kind of rooted in the brainstem. And obviously when things are hard, you know, if you're being attacked by a charging lion in the savannah, or these days someone suddenly is cutting you off in traffic and getting really aggressive with you, or maybe you just have a situation where, you know, someone in your life is in a conflict with you. You know, you need to rise to the occasion or deal with social injustice, you know, help make the world a better place. We do need to be able to fire up. But as the book goes into, the brain basically has two settings. It's kind of green zone responsive mode, which is where it defaults when there's an underlying felt sense of our core needs being met, our three fundamental needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. That's our resting state, the green zone. We also have this mode, we fire up into the red zone reactive mode when we need to fight or flight, right? Or freeze, let's say. So we need both settings, but Mother Nature's plan is for animals, including us, to spend most of their time in the green zone because it's sustainable. It's the homeostatic equilibrium condition, and the body is also repairing and refueling itself. The problem is, while in modern life most of us are not running it, you know, in fear from a charging lion, we're kind of trapped in lives with chronic mild to moderate stress in red zone, in other words, the reactive mode, with very little opportunity for recovery from them. So for me, the takeaway point is to do what we can to change the world for the better, but meanwhile, having noticed that the world doesn't change very quickly, meanwhile, we can use opportunities in everyday life to really register that our core needs are fundamentally met, overcome the negativity bias of the brain, and then increasingly we're able to deal with life's challenges while staying in the green zone, you know, and not tipping over into that red zone, which is so costly both in terms of personal well-being as well as long-term physical health.
Neuropsychologist Rick Hansen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Hardwiring as in rewiring, getting your brain to figure things out a little differently with a little assist from your conscious self. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about this, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Hansen.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Hansen, surprised on how much this segment of the program dovetails with the guests that Jeff had on just prior to you. I'd like to ask you if what you're talking about is an individual's ability to reprogram their own cells. And I'm wondering, with your last discussion on the primitive part of the brain in modern society and the chronic problem of short-term memory loss or even long-term memory loss in older people, have you done any research on how to overcome this memory loss in older people? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
That's a very important question. And slowly but surely, like everybody, becoming one of those older people, you know, I have a real interest in this. I'm not a super specialist in, for example, dementia and other more normal conditions, I would say. I think the research shows in general that common sense practices such as, you know, exercise, eating well, avoiding toxins, and using your mind as much as you can, mental activity, do tend to preserve memory function. Memory is a very vulnerable function in the brain. If you think about it, it's what tends to go when we're depressed or had a head injury or are aging. One thing also I think that people can do to protect memory function, and there's some research on this, is do some kind of contemplative practice. In addition to the good old-fashioned advice, you know, of hanging out with, of having good friends and, you know, exercise and so forth, doing some kind of prayer or mindfulness activity or both even on a regular basis does probably protect memory function, and there's some beginning signs of this. For one, it can help reduce stress, and cortisol, as produced by stress, is very bad for a key region of the brain, the hippocampus, which is very involved in protecting memory and doing memory for us. And then second, one thing that any kind of contemplative practice, meditation, and so forth can do for a person, including, you know, practices that are fairly brief, but hopefully, you know, routine, even daily, like 10 minutes or so or more even a day, is that those practices build up structures in the brain that are involved in the executive functions, those structures being just behind your forehead in the prefrontal regions. And these executive functions help focus attention and help us sustain our attention to the experiences that we do want to take in, which is a way to support memory function.
Structurally, I mean, neuroplasticity acknowledged here, structurally, does the brain fight some of this rewiring?
The idea is very astute. The brain has to balance, on the one hand, its need to preserve a kind of stability, because otherwise, if the brain was constantly changing, right, we couldn't remember anything, because memory involves some kind of stability, right, of representing, like how to ride a bike, or navigate a tricky conversation with a loved one, or, you know, what's the capital of Oregon, for example. On the other hand, the brain has to be able to change. If it doesn't change, then people become too rigid, too reflexive. And to go to your point about the more ancient regions of the brain, those are the most rigid parts. They are the least able to learn. If you think of it metaphorically speaking, and, you know, I don't know if you're like me, even there's an experience of this, it's like having an inner lizard, mouse, and monkey inside that loosely correspond to the reptilian, mammalian, and primate stages of brain evolution. Well, the monkey inside us, or the early human, as it were, is much more able to learn than the mouse, the subcortical limbic regions, the emotional brain, so-called. And that inner mouse is more able to learn than the inner lizard. So if you're grappling with issues that feel particularly rigid, especially related to threat, because that's what the ancient reptilian brainstem is most focused on. You know, rule one in the wild is, you know, live to see the sunrise. Eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, right? So if you're grappling with issues of anxiety or anger or trauma or feelings of helplessness or feeling unprotected, all of which get at the ancient need for safety, which is managed very much by the brainstem and related structures at its root, well, those experiences of anxiety need a lot of counter conditioning. They need a lot of alternative learning. You need to pet the lizard a lot. So you need to take in the good a lot in terms of experiences that are real for you, like feeling strong or relaxed or noticing you're all right now or feeling protected or feeling safer, because those are, as it were, antidote experiences that particularly target feelings of anxiety and particularly address those ancient reptilian needs to stay out of trouble.
We have a call here for Rick Hansen, the author of Hardwiring Happiness. Here's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Rick.
Hi there, good morning.
A couple of comments and then a question for you, Rick. First of all, my contemplative exercise is I do crossword puzzles, which I find is very good because I come from an English major background, so I'm kind of like focused in the English language and words and in manipulation thereof. And another thing that, here's something I did, which I think developed a very good memory with regard to the little darlings who were doing the trick-or-treating yesterday, last night. I offered them, and I showed them the packages of each. I showed them the packages of some prepackaged prunes, and I threw those into the bags with them. And when their faces fell, I showed them the package of the candy, and I put candy in their bags around the same time as I put the prunes around in. And so I think I made a permanent impression upon them that this is the guy who tricked them and treated them at the same time. And my question is to you, Rick, is that this is a theory. I've asked this of other guests on Jeffrey's program before. It's like, why do you think it is that the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body and vice versa? Because I think it was because back in evolutionary days, if one was attacked at the head part, they needed the other side of the body to defend itself and Jeffrey, if any of that makes any sense with your guest, I'll just take his responses off of the phone.
All right. I'm not sure the prunes make sense, but the rest of it's fine. Thanks for that, James. Appreciate it.
That's great. Well, a couple things there. Three, actually. One is that kids are very quick to change their brain based on their experiences. So I think that there's also a lot of opportunity for people who are parents or teachers to look for opportunities with children to help them actually take the extra 10 or 20 seconds to register their experiences, especially positive ones, so they sink in. Maybe their natural opportunities at school, moments of reflection, or just before recess, or just after recess, or at the end of a day. And also, parents can do this kind of thing with kids, you know, just before sleep. Second, and I'll be quick on this one, the question about the bilateral crossover of the brain, you know, the left side, as your caller points out, controlling the right side of the body, et cetera, why in the world would that originate? And there are different theories about that, and I think your caller's theory is extremely plausible.
All right, that you need the other side if you're attacked on the left side of your head to be able
to
fight off the battle there.
That's
much
right.
More to talk about with Dr. Rick Hansen. His book is Hardwiring Happiness, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return. Dr. Rick Hansen and your phone calls and emails back on the Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is neuropsychologist Rick Hansen. He's written a book called Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Yes, we do have a negativity bias in our brains. It keeps us from getting into situations that can harm us over and over again. But it also means that we have to do some work to rewire, which is what hardwiring happiness is all about. We can do some of that rewiring ourselves by linking, among other things, positive and negative experiences. We'll get to the details as we go along. You can join our discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jeannie in Medford dropped a question off about why people hold grudges. And let me throw on top of that my question about your general thought on free-floating grumpiness, not necessarily attached to any one experience or a series of them.
Right. Well, I think the holding on to grudges is a great example of the negativity bias, because if you think about it, you know, there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, resentment, grudges, is taking poison and then waiting for others to die. In other words, it harms us usually much more than the other person to hold on to the grudge, and yet we still do it. And I think that's an example of the negativity bias, in that the brain overlearns from those negative experiences and then really protects them, because that's a great way to keep animals alive in the wild. But, you know, as anyone who's held a grudge, me included, knows, it's a lousy way to, you know, experience quality of life and so forth. So for me, what's useful is to find that middle place where you're both recognizing mistreatment. You know, you're not being a doormat, and you're doing whatever is appropriate and you can to assert yourself, and also have compassion for yourself and be on your own side, while at the same time trying to, you know, move on, trying to get your mind out of it. You know, if it's bad enough that they did that thing to you in the first place, even worse if you let them keep doing it to you, banging around inside your own head. And then second, in terms of free-floating grumpiness, there's a term in psychology called defensive pessimism. And there's a place, I think, and some people use it to kind of orient to life in a slightly aversive way, or a, kind of a grumpy or you know, anxious or worried way. I mean, it is a strategy. The problem with that is that while it can accomplish certain purposes, you know, in terms of energizing oneself if you're grumpy, or alerting oneself to threats, you know, or if you're grumpy or if you're anxious, on the other hand, maybe there's a better way to get that same beneficial result. Maybe we can, you know, see the real negative things in the world clearly without starting with a certain free-floating grumpiness. That said, you know, the truth is, Jeff, everybody has got a temperament. We're all messed up. You know what I mean? And, you know, my temperament tends to be a little mildly anxious. I have one of my best friends. His temperament tends to be free-floating grumpiness. You know, I just saw him last night. And, you know, and other people may be kind of mopey in their own temperament. And that's okay. I think sometimes people You know, they feel bad because they have a temperament, and the truth is, it's just your temperament. The question is, though, is there a freedom in relationship to it, or is it running the show?
Ah, good point. Let us take a call here from Skeeter in Eugene. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Hansen. His book is Hardwiring Happiness.
Hiya, gents. What a great day, even with the gray.
Mm-hmm.
A while back, I was listening to a program that suggested that about 85% of the stuff that we worry about either never did happen or is not going to happen, and that there's only about 15% of the stuff that we worry about that we really ought to pay attention to. And then also, a couple of years ago, a really great psychologist counselor suggested to me that when I'm focusing on the really good experiences that I'm having and I'm feeling really good or I'm feeling real positive about directions that I'm making, to not only dwell on that, as your guest suggests, you know, for 15, 20 seconds and really integrate it into your system, but to actually do something physical, even subtly physical, such as rubbing your index finger against your thumb very lightly, or letting your hand rest on your chest to feel your heart, to integrate that mind-body connection, to actually get the physicality mixed in with that thinking so that the next time something stressful happens, you can rub your fingers together lightly, and that can bring you back into the moment and realize, oh, I'm making choices all the time. How do I want to deal with this? I want to move into a positive direction. All that stuff that you had when you initially were doing that, when you were having those positive experiences, I think it really helps. It works for me, and I highly suggest it. Anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for that, Skeeter. Let's take another call from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Hansen. His book is Hardwiring Happiness.
Yes, hi. Hey, Rick. I greatly appreciate your work. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you.
And I've got some of your CDs and listened to them, and I've actually attended a lot of the webinars you presented at, and I've enjoyed them all. Okay, that said, I think that the kind of strategies that you and other folks propose to take in the good sometimes work a whole lot better when the people trying to apply them have had the great gift of growing up in a state of being securely attached, because that provides a basis of internal safety for coping with life's difficulties, and when you get knocked off, you can find your way back quicker. Because I think such people with insecure attachment are much more readily derailed by any kind of unexpected negative experience, and they have a much harder time making it back because they might have a lot of shame triggered by their negative experience and tend to blame themselves for their difficulties. So when I hear statements like, most people are about as happy as they decide to be, I think they often land in such people as yet another failure when they can't just decide to be happy like everybody's telling they should be.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd like to see is strategies specifically designed to support change in people who've grown up with insecure attachment, because it is so much more difficult to get back to enough of a steady state of relative safety so they can actually use the strategy you propose. I think that might help people who have a really hard time focusing on the good to learn how to do so.
All right. Thanks for that call, Sandy. Thoughts, Rick?
I think that's really a deep point. And by the way, Sandy, thank you for your kindness here to me personally. On the one hand, it's really true that if there are already more senses of more of a sense of resources inside, including secure attachment, you know, let's say rooted in a good childhood, then it's certainly easier to draw upon them for some felt sense of the good. On the one hand, on the other hand, you know, as someone who's been working with people a really long time and had his own rocky childhood, I have really come to appreciate the extraordinary power of the mind and brain system to gradually change itself for the better, you know, the self-directed neuroplasticity idea. And so I think it's especially true that if someone has had an insecurely attached childhood or other experiences of feeling mistreated or just not getting enough of the good stuff, then everyday life is particularly important to draw upon to look for those moments to really have an experience that's your own antidote experience, as I've said earlier, of, let's suppose, in terms of attachment, feeling included or seen or appreciated or liked or loved. Any one of those, you know, any part in a storm can gradually, slowly but surely fill the hole in your heart. And it's only 10 or 20 or 30 seconds at a time. You know, it's one drop at a time. But drop by drop, you know, as the Buddha talked about a long time ago, using a metaphor, drop by drop is the water pot filled. And I have seen so many people, I suspect, you know, the caller's on the path himself. I've just seen so many people who really have gradually done this thing, bit by bit, you know, informally in daily life. And then, you know, in my book, I get into the, you know, ways to turbocharge this process. But you can really fill the hole in your heart gradually over time. I certainly have, and I've known not many other people who've done that too.
Kit in Arcata writes, it seems to me that religious practice, such as Christian prayer or Buddhist meditation practice, is a time-tested method of rewiring the brain. Could your guest comment on how this might be an important evolved function of religions for human beings, balancing out our natural anxieties, allowing us to focus more on the positive, not only momentarily, but throughout our lives?
That's a very interesting point, and an area of a lot of interest these days, and also controversy, of course. So 2 points about it quickly. First point, the research on the impact on the brain of, you know, meditation or other forms of contemplative practice is really remarkable. Now, most of that research has been done on either TM, which is essentially a Hindu type of practice, or on mindfulness meditation, more of a Buddhist type practice, although people can do either of those practices outside of their original religious context. There have been some studies on Christian practices, but not very many. Nonetheless, those studies show that meditation is actually really good for the brain, including, for example, building up structure in the brain in regions that are involved in both self-awareness and empathy for others, and also regions that do the executive functions I spoke about earlier, just behind the forehead, you know, regulating attention and our feelings and our actions. So that's good. Second, as to whether you know, religion is an evolutionarily evolved way to support the brain or confer other benefits, that's a really complicated question. People, I think, over the ages have learned to do various things that work, whether it's, you know, going for a walk with a friend or standing out underneath the stars, you know, with a sense of awe, or doing some kind of inner practice that quiets the mind and maybe one that is linked to some felt sense of something transcendental, something divine, something religious in that sense. So I think different things work to draw upon the capacities of the brain to be centered and so forth. I don't think the brain evolved in order to stand under the stars and feel awe, and I just am not sure at all whether the brain evolved in order to apprehend the transcendental, if you're like me and think there is an X factor out there. I think the brain mainly evolved to, if not entirely evolved, to keep animals alive. That said, we still have capacities to compose symphonies or do crossword puzzles, as a caller said. The brain didn't evolve to do crossword puzzles or make symphonies, but it does have the capacities to do those things and then draw upon them, going to the focus of my book, draw upon those useful experiences, not wasting them, to help them have some kind of lasting value that steepens our own learning curve as we go through life.
Rick Hansen, I want to return to the HEAL acronym, Have a Positive Experience, Enrich It, Absorb It, Link Positive and Negative. One of the things you talk about is separating liking from wanting good experiences. What's the difference between liking and wanting in this context?
Very interesting. Okay, two parts. So first, again, quickly, HEAL just, as you say, means it's the how of turning passing mental states into lasting neural traits. In other words, it's a fancy way of describing how can we take good experiences in everyday life into ourselves to build up good stuff inside ourselves in lasting ways. So that's what that acronym is about. And then, I've completely slipped on the second part of your question.
It was the liking and wanting.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, it is said that liking without wanting is heaven, but wanting without liking is hell. In other words, in many ways, the art in life, I think from any kind of framework, and certainly it's true and from a more Eastern perspective, is to be able to find the middle way in which we are enjoying what's pleasant, where we are tolerating what's unpleasant, but we're not tipping into craving, so-called, with reference to either what's pleasant or unpleasant. In other words, we're not shifting out of the experience just in the moment of something being, you know, pleasant or unpleasant, liking or not liking. We're not tipping from that into wanting in the problematic sense of the word wanting. In other words, we're not tipping into a sense of drivenness and addiction, let's say, for what's pleasant, or going to war with what's unpleasant. The art, I think, is to be able to be, you know, passionate and ambitious and strong for what's difficult in life without getting sucked into the underlying sense of deficit or disturbance that drives the red zone of the brain, its reactive mode, which is a way to talk about, you know, in a modern neuropsychological way, as it were, the second noble truth of Buddhism, the truth of what actually is craving. I think the art is to repeatedly take in positive experiences so that we can rest in what's pleasant and let it be a passing experience. We can rest in what's unpleasant and let it be a passing experience while staying in the green zone, as it were, while staying responsive in relationship to what's pleasant or unpleasant without moving into fight or flight or freeze with regard to it.
So finally then, why link positive with negative experiences?
Super great question. As usual, I should listen to you more often. You know, the idea is to have the positive decontaminate the negative. In other words, to do what people do routinely in everyday life, and especially happens routinely in therapy, where we hold both positive and negative material in awareness at the same time. For example, you could have a present moment sense of just being cared about. You know, on the 0 to 10 intensity scale, it's a 1 or a 2, but it's still real. Maybe someone's nice to you at work, or your cat crawls into your lap, as happens for me, or maybe someone compliments you about something or other. Okay, you're now having this experience, and you want to let it be very real. Like the caller said who talked about rubbing his finger and thumb together, you want to anchor it in your body. You want it to become really strong for you, okay? At the same time, if you want, you could be aware of some current life experience of feeling mistreated or put down or excluded by somebody, hurt, or even bring up childhood material where you felt abandoned, maybe your own experience of insecure attachment, let's say. And then by holding both of those in awareness at the same time, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, only for a little bit of time, you can gradually sense that the positive material is connecting with and easing and even eventually replacing the negative material.
Great. So clearing out the old bad stuff. The process is called Hardwiring Happiness. Rick Hansen is the author of the book by that name. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeff. It was a pleasure.
Good to have you. Monday on the Jefferson Exchange, we'll talk about the Veterans Home in Redding, the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. We'll talk about what it does, and we'll tell a tale of the War of 1812 in the book The Shining Sea. That's all Monday. Our producer, Charlotte Dern, our student assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and set the clocks back.